Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. Hello, I'm Kevin Kelton. I'm a moderate Democrat, or I like to think so, and I live in Los Angeles, California, or I like to think so.
Hi, I'm DJ McGuire. I'm pretty sure I live in Suffolk, Virginia, and I'm also fairly certain I'm a conservative Democrat.
I'm Greg Matuszak. I'm a liberal Democrat. I see a trend here. From Cincinnati, Ohio.
I'm Rebecca Kushmider. I am also a Democrat, a liberal one at that, in Kensington, Maryland.
And although we are all Democrats tonight, we think that we still span the political spectrum. Some of us are more liberal. DJ is decidedly on the conservative side, so it won't be – you won't be listening to a Bernie Sanders rally here. The More Perfect Union – unless I do my imitation. The More Perfect Union can now be heard on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Facebook, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com. Where you can also find host bios and written commentary. And we've had a lot of commentary there this week, thanks to DJ and some of the other members of our crew. This week, we're going to start off not in politics, but in the world of entertainment, because the news story that has been taking over the 24-hour cable news world is Harvey Weinstein. And we thought that we also should weigh in on the issue. He's gotten kicked out of virtually everything you could get kicked out of in Hollywood.
Including a company that used to bear his name. It's hard to get kicked out of your own company.
And he deserved every one of them. What do you guys think? First of all, is there enough of a discipline yet? Unless he gets convicted, can anything ever match his alleged crimes?
Yeah, a jail, a prison. I think that's where we're headed. For the years. I mean, decades of abuse that he heaped upon women, innocent women. We're talking rape and sexual assault. Yes, there's a place for that. It's called prison, and that's where he deserves to be. And is there enough? Yes. And this is just literally the tip of the iceberg. And all of this seems terrible. Yes, he has lost his company. He has lost the respect. He has lost. Today was he was outed from the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Science, which is a big deal. I mean, this is a respected organization, and they sent a scathing statement.
The most interesting sentence in the Oscars statement was the era of sexual abuse and manipulation is over, or something like that. I've lost the exact phrase, but it sounded like the Academy is acknowledging that it's an industry-wide problem, that it has been an industry-wide problem. I mean, and it goes back to the studio system. This is not new, and it's time to not only acknowledge it, but do something about it. It can't just be the worst kept secret anymore.
So what can that industry, and frankly, I think we'll agree that this is not just a Hollywood problem. It's a problem wherever there are men with penises. But getting back to Hollywood, where there are too many men with penises, what can be done there to alleviate the problem?
One thing I would like to see is female performers asking for clauses in contracts that award them automatic something in the event that they are harassed by a person involved in a production.
That's very interesting. I never thought of that. Yeah.
Give women the power to exercise some sort of clause that enables them to say, you guys blew it, now you owe me. And put some of the power in the hands of people who've really had to put up with it because they would lose a job if they reported it. They would lose the possibility of their next job.
A career.
Yeah, a whole career.
That's 10 jobs. Right.
Yeah.
I mean.
And obviously it's a cultural issue. We have to change the way men relate to other men and, frankly, the way women relate to other women. You know, it was nice to hear this week that there was a support network of women who tried to reach out to other women about Harvey Weinstein, but it was too private, maybe too hush-hush. Whatever it was, and I commend the women that did try to do something, it didn't get the job done. And And I've been thinking about this a lot this week. Rebecca and I traded a couple of ideas on Facebook. We see it slightly differently. Now, listen, I have to preface this by saying I think Harvey Weinstein's a monster, and there is not one person who came in contact with him who isn't an innocent victim. No one brought this on themselves. No one is to blame. That said, I think that there's a choice that people need to think about when put in these situations. The choice is, when you see something, you really should say something. Now, I know that's easy for me sitting behind a microphone, behind my laptop, in my white bread community to say, but I've been in difficult situations in my life, not as difficult as these women's words. But we all have a responsibility. You know, in the codes of conducts of most major companies, there is now a clause called a duty to report. That if you see somebody violating the code of conduct of that company, you have a duty to report it, even if it is your immediate superior or even if it is the CEO of the company. Now, that doesn't make it any easier to do. It's a scary thing because there are real world repercussions for taking a stand and putting your neck out there. But if the first three women who Harvey had ever tried this with had spoken up forcefully or gone to the police or taken matters into their own hands and made him realize that he cannot touch another human being when they don't want to be touched, he probably would have adapted the way he relates to women, and this may not have happened to many of the women who became his victims. And again, I understand what they were afraid of, and I understand that people saw their entire careers possibly on the line. I know that. Doing the right thing is not always easy. Doing the right thing sometimes can have an unfair disadvantage to you, but you still should try to do the right thing. And I think reporting these things is the right thing to do.
Well, here's the thing about the reporting. There is a reflex in American society. I don't know if this is the world at large, but certainly in America, to question women's perceptions of things that have happened to them. If you tell a man that you were catcalled on the street, his response will be what? It's a compliment. And it's not a compliment. It's harassment. But men don't visualize it that way. They don't interpret it that way. They don't know what it feels like to be walking down the street and have somebody start commenting on your appearance or making suggestions about what they'd like to do to you. And I don't, maybe this has happened to you guys, and I don't know your whole histories, but I don't know that you all know the feeling of having the hairs on the back of your neck stand up and your heart start to race and your palms start to sweat as you're just trying to get where you're going and you want to figure out, am I about to be under attack? What do I need to do now? And then you go tell a guy about it, and he says, oh, I'm sure you're imagining it. Well, guys are cops, and cops will say, you were imagining it, or we can't do anything, it was just words. Or if he didn't leave marks on you, if he didn't do this, why didn't you report it? There are a million barriers put in place for women to report these things because no one wants to believe it happened. I don't know if it's that men trust each other above women, or that they view interactions so differently that they don't understand what hostility really is. And that's a problem.
Let me ask you, Rebecca, because I have to be honest with you. I think you're describing a stereotype of men in the 60s and maybe into the 70s and even the early 80s. I don't think that's the male. There are men that think like that. But I don't think that's the predominant male psychology.
What is the average age of a studio head? How old is Harvey Weinstein?
Well, Harvey Weinstein is older than the average age of a studio head.
Right, but that's who's in power. That's who's at the top of this, Kevin. And the fish rots from the head.
But this wasn't an issue of people thinking, oh, Harvey would never do that. Jennifer Lawrence or whoever the actress is must be mistaken. Everybody knew it was true.
But the first few times when it was just him copping a feel in a restaurant, those first three times that you hypothesized, That's what it was. But that's where you don't start with raping someone in a hotel room. You start with patting your waitress on the bottom, and everyone around you is like, haha, yeah, she's cute. And she hated that.
No, it does happen, Kevin. I didn't say it doesn't happen. I've never been in a situation where a guy did that and anyone laughed or enabled it. I've never seen it. Maybe Greg or DJ have. No. I can only speak for myself.
I would have said something.
Yeah, I can't. I can't say that I have witnessed a situation like that. But I think there's an angle that we're missing here, and that angle is the authorities themselves. We now know that Cyrus Vance Jr., the District Attorney of Manhattan, had a tape in his possession from a victim of Weinstein's. And the tape actually has him admitting to assaulting her. He chose not to push the case forward. He also chose not to push a case forward against Trump. And one of Trump's lawyers handed him a nice big contribution for $32,000 after he chose to drop the case. And that's just what we know from the New York District, the New York County District Attorney's Office, Manhattan Island. We don't know how the Los Angeles city attorneys behaved or chose not to behave. We don't know, I don't know, what role, if any, the California Attorney General's office would have in any of this. If it's like Virginia's, then they're not involved in direct prosecution. But certainly the Los Angeles County city attorney or whoever handles prosecutions in Los Angeles County has a lot to answer for, just as Mr. Vance, frankly, has a lot to answer for. And while we can talk about the cultural problem, when you talk about the corporate culture problem and everything else, we also need to talk about the fact that the authorities in these localities did nothing, and in particular did nothing when they had evidence with which they could have done something. This is about more than just the company and the culture. This is about the people elected to oversee that culture, the people elected to protect, the elected officials who are specifically elected to protect the people in the criminal justice system, speaking for us in prosecuting offenders, who chose not to do a damn thing about it.
Right. And Billy Bush, who was with Donald Trump when we've heard that tape about a year ago.
No, he did enable.
He not only enabled that little worm.
He laughed during the whole thing.
And then he encouraged that poor actress to give Donald Trump a hug.
I know,
knowing that he was the worst.
I wanted to throw up when I saw that.
But that's the thing. And if you don't think that people, I know you've never been in that situation, but Donald Trump was telling him, this is what I tried to get on a married woman, and I've attacked women in the past. And he was killing himself laughing. And he's like, oh, here, have some Tic Tacs. We'll go after it. Now give him a hug. This was terrible. And if Billy Bush ever works again, I hope to God he never works again. He shouldn't. He should go to jail too, if you ask me.
So let me throw out a couple of things that I think would demonstrably help the situation. First of all, I would like to see the California legislature, and frankly, the legislature of every state, pass a law that says you cannot sign a non-disclosure agreement about criminal activity. It is not legally acceptable and will not hold up in court. That way you do away with these settlements where some woman takes $150,000 and then can never be used to testify about a crime committed on her that was also committed against other people who might need corroborating testimony.
That's been a big deal in military contracting, because contractors have to sign mandatory arbitration agreements, and women who have civilians who've been working in war zones like Iraq have often faced sexual violence and then have had no ability to to prosecute.
Right. Well, I don't believe. I also believe that there should not be mandatory arbitration agreements, but that's a whole other issue. The other thing that, on an individual level, if you're an actress out there or an actor, this is what you can do today to protect yourself. You tell your agent that you will never take a meeting in a hotel room with someone of the opposite sex.
Or even of the same sex.
Hotel room. There is no reason in the world for there to be a business meeting in a hotel room. I was in the entertainment business for over 35 years. I worked on 22 television shows. I worked for every network. I worked at or was represented by the major agencies in the entertainment business. I have never been asked to go to somebody's hotel room for a meeting. If they're staying in a hotel and they need to meet you there for convenience, you meet them in the lobby. You meet them in the restaurant. You don't meet them in their hotel room. Those meetings should never have taken place. Those young women, again, they were the victims. I'm not blaming them. But had they been really thinking, as soon as somebody said, Harvey wants you to show up at room 308 at the Beverly Wilshire to discuss such and such with him, you call your agent and you say, please tell them I'd be happy to meet Mr. Weinstein in his office or in the lobby of the hotel. I will not go to his room.
And that's fair. I mean, that, but that's, you know, that's business conduct, and that should be an entirely non-controversial thing to say. But it seems like there was enough fear of retribution from Harvey Weinstein that women would set aside.
You know what the fear was? The fear was, I may not get a break that I want. Okay, those women were in a transactional situation, even though they didn't ask to be in one. They were trading on the potential to get a great movie role that would launch their careers. And frankly, you know what? Not everybody gets to be a movie star. And if it's not in the cards for you, it's not in the cards for you. But you don't get to transact on your looks for them. And if you go to that hotel room thinking that Harvey wants to talk to you because of your great talent, you're fooling yourself. You're deluding yourself. There is a way to do business in Hollywood, and you don't have to be a 56-year-old white male to understand it. Anyone who's over 21 and hasn't come from a very cloistered background knows that you don't go in private to the room of a guy like Harvey Weinstein for any reason.
Right, but you know, Bill Cosby or Roger Ailes, regardless, and not get assaulted. So,
right, you are saying though that they did not deserve this, though, right?
Of course they didn't deserve it. No one deserves it. They're all victims, and I would do anything to help those women recover from the trauma that they've gone through. I'm just trying to help women who haven't gone through it yet avoid it in the future. Okay, so elsewhere in the news this week, the Trump administration yet again tried to repeal and replace Obamacare by rolling back some very important price supports that were built into the ACA and by doing some other hocus pocus that's probably going to make everybody else's lives miserable. Rebecca, what did they exactly do to these price supports? Were these the supports or the subsidies that go to individual consumers, or what is it that Donald Trump did away with?
Yes, these are price supports. They're income supports for the insurance industry. These aren't the subsidies that are going to individual policyholders. However, they haven't been appropriated. The money technically isn't unlocked, and the Obama administration was continuing to make payments. The House of Representatives had actually sued the Obama administration, saying that they weren't authorized to make payments using money that had not been appropriated. The case had sort of stalled out because, you know, there was an election and stuff. And I believe Tom Price was actually the named party in the case. I think it was Price versus Obama. And so Trump has been threatening to do this all along, saying, well, we already knew that you weren't really supposed to be doing this anyways, Obama, so I can just do this. And he's doing it. And what it's going to do is cut off a revenue stream for the insurance companies who are going to want to replace that money, and they're going to do it by raising premiums. And if it goes with a 1-2 punch of these association health plans, which can skirt the ACA regulations on what insurance should be, what the federal minimum standards for insurance are, It means that a lot of people are going to find their way into these association plans, stay away from the higher priced plans that are ACA compliant, and it's going to destabilize the entire insurance industry. Now, of course, Congress could fix it by appropriating funds for the insurance industry subsidies, but Congress doesn't appropriate stuff. They haven't in years. The regular order appropriations is a relic, sort of like dinosaurs and cars with fins.
Yeah, Congress hasn't done anything in years. I mean, that's a joke, right? I assume you're being sarcastic.
No.
Well, let me ask you this. Why didn't they build in a congressional mechanism for funding this in the original ACA?
They
I don't
understand did. Why it was done this they way. Did. They just, Congress has to authorize the money cycle by cycle, and they didn't authorize it for the past couple of fiscal years.
Oh.
It was Republicans punishing Obama for this. Yeah.
Yeah. Did anyone see Kasich this morning on the press?
Yes.
No. Was he being an asshole?
Yes. Sort of.
He was pretty cool, actually, Greg. I wanted to ask you about that today. I'm glad you brought it up.
I will. You can. Go ahead. You tell me why. Let me do my, aw, shucks, there. My Kasich impression.
Okay.
Aw, shucks.
Did he mention that his dad was a postman?
So cool? So bring it in. Yeah. And you know, he only brought up his dad was a postman like five times.
Oh, so he was really on topic.
He was like, and I don't want to talk about the good old days about Reagan, but gosh, you know, Reagan used to be the big tent party, and we did things, we built things. My dad was a postman. Yeah, aw, shucks. And he said that. But tell me what you thought, because if you don't, I will, and then I'll tell you why he's an asshole.
I'd love to hear you talk about that, but I was going to save this for the kind of the denouement. But I'll lead with it. That's okay. I'm watching Kasich this morning, and I'm starting to think, you know what? Maybe he's going to mount. Hold on. Why are you laughing at me already, Greg? I mean,
because I already know what he's going to say. Go on. I just love. I'm getting ready.
A third party candidacy, an independent candidacy in 2020 to clip Trump's wings. So
yeah,
the
sure.
Democratic I've been saying that since wins. February. There was something he did.
You, you're a woman.
No, he won't do that.
No, there was something he did, like, way back, right after the inauguration, where I said, mark it, he's laying plans for 2020. He's going to primary Trump.
Yes, but I'm not saying primary Trump. I'm saying that I think he's going to run third-party independent.
Maybe he'll do that.
He's not going to run third-party.
But I've been saying this for months.
Which would almost assure, who knows, maybe he'd actually win. But I think it would really, really lower the chances of Trump winning.
No, somebody would give his lawyer a campaign contribution, and then nobody would press charges or something.
Okay,
DJ, tell him why. Tell him why he's not going to run third party. Because
John,
you're going to say
there was a period of about 18 hours when I was a John Kasich supporter. It was right after Ted Cruz had dropped out, and that was really John Kasich's moment. It was just him and Donald Trump. One-on-one, there were a number
mono
of primaries
mono.
Left. Yeah, enough primaries left where they could have denied, where Kasich could have denied Trump a majority of the delegates. He basically had the position he wanted to save the Republican Party from Donald Trump, to save what was left of the conservative movement from Donald Trump. And instead, he chose to back out of the race. He doesn't have the spine to do this. Not then.
Yeah.
Not now, not in 2020.
It could be. But going back to what he was doing this morning, okay? So okay. He was because he's an asshole quite a bit, obviously, like a year ago and today and probably tomorrow. But he was talking about how governors, this is just the wrong thing. It's wrong to throw people off health care. And I was like, well, that's true. It is wrong. He goes, morally, it's wrong. And he was going on and... And I was like, yeah, but then he said something really funny, who hosts Meet the Press? Help me, the little
Chuck
guy.
Chuck Todd.
Chuck Todd says, so what are you doing to prepare for this, like many other governors? He said, good point. He goes, we have a account, and we're going to pay for these ourselves in the short term, but you don't know. Now, this is the part that I have an issue with. because he balanced, and I use my air quotes, he balanced our budget that he talks about all the time. We now have a huge surplus by cutting funds to local municipalities and small cities, and cutting, just shredding them for schools, education, police, everything, and saying, you guys are on your own because we're withholding state funds on all those things, and now deal with it. And he's never given those funds back, the funds that everything that we depended on. And for like years, we were like, where's that money? And he goes, oh, we're keeping it. This is the new budget because we need this, these funds to balance the budget. And now all of a sudden, the federal government is saying, hey, you don't get your money because this is how it goes. Because wait, shit rolls downhill. And all of a sudden, it's coming down on him. And he's like, wait, wait, this is inhumane. But it wasn't inhumane when police departments were cut, when emergency services were cut, when schools had to be cut, teachers. All of a sudden, it was like, well, we had to make the financial and responsible decision. And that's why Kasich's an asshole. Oh, wait. Yeah.
Somebody asked us about that on the More Perfect Union Facebook page this week. Like, why does that one host keep calling this guy an asshole? What?
Is oh my really gosh! Fair? Go.
And getting back to just health insurance quickly, and again, we're arguing about health insurance, and understandably so, because there have been disruptions. But we are once again not talking about the problems in the health care markets. We're not talking about the certificate of public need regimes, where states are simply restricting healthcare offerings to all of us. We're not talking about, well, this is not a healthcare issue as much as a health insurance issue, but we're not talking about how the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which has essentially created monopsony power in terms of setting rates for health insurers, essentially handed it all over to the American Medical Association and gave them monopoly power. It's like falling in love with a house and making the owner of that house your real estate agent. It's just about the dumbest thing you could possibly do. And these things are continually increasing healthcare prices, which indirectly increase health insurance rates because they increase the cost to health insurers. And yet no one is doing anything about them. It's as if we're all trying to argue about how best to keep the lid on the pot, and no one will turn the effing oven off.
Preaching to the choir, DJ. Preaching to the choir. That's why we have all Democrats on here. Amen. So that we can just applaud when DJ says smart stuff.
Yeah.
I'm still having trouble getting used to that, but go on.
being the only smart person here, you'll get used to
no,
it.
No, no. Having Democrats applaud my every word, I'm still having trouble getting used to that.
Well, no, we don't applaud your every word, just the smart ones.
Yeah, okay. Not so fast coming up. We may stop you in just a moment.
Yeah, we may stop you with the Iran deal's decertification, which I think may be the stupidest thing that the Trump administration has done to date. But DJ,
is it stupider
where do you
than
stand
referring to Kim Jong Un as Lil Rocket Man?
Yeah, there's a lot of stupid to compare this with, just from an objective.
I know,
an objective, absolutely. I know. Level. The other thing is, we have to remember what this actually is. This is not blowing up the deal itself, or saying that it isn't even saying that Iran is necessarily violating the deal. The certification is whether or not the deal is in the national security interests of the United States. And for those of us who thought this agreement in and of itself was never a good idea, of course it's not in the best interest, national security interest of the United States. And for once, Donald Trump did the right thing by saying so. When this thing was first put together 2 years ago, I said at the time, and I probably even said it on this podcast, that this was a bad idea, that it was doing nothing but delaying, not actually stopping, Iran becoming a nuclear power. And in exchange for what was essentially 10 years of waiting for to become a nuclear power, Iran got to move forward on ballistic missiles. They got to move forward with greater economic prosperity, not for the people of Iran, but for the ruling regime. They got to continue their terrorist activities in the Middle East. They got to continue to prop up the murderous regime in Syria. And for what? For saying, okay, yeah, we're going to hold off on advancing our nuclear weapons program. Not stopping it, mind you, just holding off on it for 10 years. It was a ridiculous deal, and Trump was right to decertify it. The question now is going to be, will Congress take the next step and say, you know something? we need to put more conditions on this deal. We need to expand it just to include all of the other nefarious things that the Iranian regime is doing. And I don't know if Congress has the spine to do that. They don't seem to have the spine to do anything these days. Yeah, I don't really think this actually changes anything, because I don't think Congress will actually do anything. It's just Donald Trump, for once, seeing reality and accepting it for what it is.
Well, it's interesting that Donald Trump has this habit, and we saw it with the immigration stuff. We've seen it with the way he keeps tossing things to Congress in healthcare, and now this. He keeps handing over executive power, just tossing it back to Congress, and keeps saying, "Congress, here's the problem. You go fix it." And I had a friend who used to rant about the imperial presidency, that we'd concentrated too much power in the executive branch. And Donald Trump is pretty consistently trying to dispel some of that power. The problem is Congress isn't picking it up and doing anything with it. They seem to be very, very confused.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump doesn't throw things back to Congress because he expects them to make progress. He throws things back to Congress because his hands are tied and he just wants a scapegoat. That's number one. Number two, DJ, I'm sorry, it was short-lived. I have to take back your smartest person on the broadcast.
I didn't think that would last. I knew it wouldn't last. No worries.
Well, let me go back to, DJ, some things that I'm going to take issue with you on your original comments about the Iran deal. First of all, you said that I want to get this straight. You said he didn't say they weren't in compliance. He did say they weren't in compliance. He specifically said that on Friday.
Okay. I was referring to what decertification actually is. Decertification is not a question.
I know what decertification is.
But if he said that, then he said that. That's fine. Right. I think he's right on that too. Okay. But we'll move on.
Okay. Secondly, the overall problem with this matter, this issue, this policy, is the people who are critics of the Obama administration's immense efforts over 5 or 6 plus years to work out this deal. The people who say we should pull it, it's the worst deal ever made, it didn't do enough, it only froze their program for 10 years, it didn't eliminate it entirely. They're coming from a point of view that there was a better deal to be had. And there is no evidence that there was a better deal to be had. When you have the State Department, and I don't care whether it's a Republican State Department or a Democratic State Department, when you send the State Department and all of its assets and resources in to negotiate a deal, and they spend 5 years working with a hostile regime, bringing in other superpowers, and finally hammer out an agreement, I think we should take it at face value that that was the best goddamn deal that they could get. And for us to sit back, or for Donald Trump to sit back and go, they could have gotten this and they didn't even address that. There was a reason that stuff wasn't on the table, because the Iranians weren't going to discuss it. And sanctions got them to the bargaining table where we were able to work out this deal. The idea that we are going to decertify this agreement, whether it was a valid treaty or not, it was a treaty in place, whether we are going to decertify it and start imposing more sanctions, which is what Trump wants Congress to do, and that the Iranians are going to fold and come back to the table and swallow more demands, it's ludicrous. Does anyone seriously believe that the Iranians are going to eat crow and become Donald Trump's bitch just to go back to the status quo? No. They got their, first of all, they got their $150 billion in unfrozen assets. They got their $1.7 billion that was owed to them. There's no reason for them now to go back to the bargaining table and give up stuff that was already agreed to. So it is absolute insanity to think that by decertifying this and imposing more sanctions, that all of a sudden the world is going to change for Donald Trump. It's not.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying there was a better deal to be had. I'm saying no deal was better than a bad deal, and that this was a bad deal.
Why? They were 6 months to a year away from a nuclear weapon. Now they're 9 years away from it.
So that's not going to really matter in 2025. And the fact of the matter...
It matters now.
Yeah, but it won't matter in 2025. And if some of the reports...
But by 2025, you deal with the issue then. You deal with the issue when the deal comes up for renegotiation, recertification.
And I only want one rogue nuclear power being antagonized on Twitter right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, some of the reports I've seen is that one of the reasons Iran is able to freeze its nuclear weapons program is that they've essentially offloaded it to North Korea. I've seen numerous reports that North Korea is actually relying on Iran for expertise for some of their nuclear testing and their nuclear advancement, and that's why they've been able to move forward.
Well, DJ, you told me that they were using different methods. I specifically asked you a few weeks ago why North Korea was able to advance so much faster than Iran on the nuclear weapon front, and you told me it was because one was using a plutonium-based system and the other was using a uranium-based system. So how are they now offloading it?
You make a point. Okay, I'll retract. No, I'm actually remembering. I'm remembering what I said earlier. But
Kevin's the smartest on the podcast.
Getting back.
Only because I'm quoting DJ.
Yeah, I know. He used my words against myself. Well done, Kevin. But I'm taking the longer view. And the idea that it is better to allow Iran to become more prosperous economically without the sanctions, to become a greater power in the region, which Donald Trump is doing by standing with the murderous Syrian government, and by allowing them to become more wealthy and more powerful just so they can freeze their nuclear weapons program, that's not good enough for me. I'll be frank. I would rather Iran had nuclear weapons, but was still so economically crippled that they could not leverage them to greater power. The Soviet Union had more nuclear weapons than anyone on the face of the earth. It was their weak economy that killed them, that ended that regime. Iran with nuclear weapons does not scare me as much as Iran with ballistic missiles all over the place, with allies all over the Middle East, and with a strong and prosperous economy from which the ruling regime can extract wealth and gains for themselves, in addition to knowing they will eventually have nuclear weapons in 8 to 9 years. 8 to 9 years is not enough for me if the alternative is all of that stuff, which they should not have. I would have rather they said, you know what? We couldn't stop you. Go ahead. You can get a nuclear weapon or two, but we're going to keep your economy crippled. We're going to look to allies in the region, and we're going to counter-proliferate with them, or actually, what better we should do, scratch that. We're going to extend our nuclear umbrella to our allies in the region. We're going to extend it to the democracy in Iraq. We already extended it to Turkey under NATO. We're going to extend it to Oman. We're going to don't extend it to Yemen. Yemen's a mess. I would rather not extend it to Saudi Arabia.
They're all messes. The idea of having a nuclear Iraq or a nuclear Turkey
expand our nuclear umbrella, which is to say that if they are hit with a nuclear weapon, we will give a nuclear response against the country that launched it. That's what nuclear umbrella is. Not allowing them to have nuclear weapons. I pulled that back because that's wrong.
Okay. I stand corrected.
No, that's fine. That's okay.
So a nuclear umbrella isn't something we're going to be seeing in the fall issue of Vogue.
No, it's not. but the fact of the matter is, this agreement is allowing Iran to become the regional superpower they always wanted to be, and they get nuclear weapons in 8 to 9 years. They're not going to have any interest in extending this agreement in 2025. They're going to say, you know what? We have everything we want. We've saved Bashar Assad, and he's still murdering his own people. We've managed to turn Turkey against you. We have closer ties with Russia and communist China now. We're going to go on and develop our own nuclear weapons. You can throw whatever sanctions you want against us. It doesn't matter anymore. That's what's actually going to happen in 2025. This deal was not worth it. We gave up too much. It would have been better to have no deal, and I'm usually alone on this because everyone else is, we should have had no deal and then stopped them making nuclear weapons. You couldn't do that. We should have said no deal. You beat us. Yeah, you're going to end up with a few nukes, but your economy is still going to be crushed, and we're still going to do what we can to knock your regime over and replace it with one that the people of Iran can actually choose who elects them rather than this nonsense that you're pulling over us because the Iranian people aren't fooled and neither are we.
So other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
Yeah. So, okay, so we've covered some pretty dire issues this week. But
I'll
there's a
say.
Couple of issues that we wanted to bring up that actually show maybe a little hope for where things are going in this country. One that just hit the news wires earlier today, that apparently Attorney General Jeff Sessions has sent a DOJ lawyer to help with the prosecution of the murder of a transgender individual. That doesn't sound like the Jeff Sessions I know, but if it's a change, it's a welcome one in my book.
In some ways it is a change, and in some ways it isn't. This happened actually today to, it was a murdered transgender individual in Iowa, and he sent a DOJ lawyer to help out with the prosecution. And you have to remember, Sessions has been against, any sort of protection under federal law for transgender or gender identity. He's also been against marriage equality. I mean, he has been no friend of the LGBTQT community. But earlier this year, he did prosecute a white supremacist under a similar law. So you have that. Personally, I think he does this just to piss off Trump every so often when Trump makes fun of him.
But
just because he looks like a Keebler elf, he really needs to accept that about himself.
I would actually say that Jeff Sessions is an electrosexual. Because it doesn't because what really turns him on is an electrocution. And it doesn't really matter who the victim is or what the victim's preferred pronoun was. So long as it means somebody gets zapped in the end, that's good enough for Jeff Sessions. And I think that's probably what's fueling this more than anything else.
The double entendre of in the end, by the way.
You know, in the New York Times reporting about this, Vanita Gupta, who'd been head of the Civil Rights Division at the DOJ under Obama, commented that, you know, we know where the line is with Jeff Sessions. You can discriminate against people, you can exclude them, but you can't kill or beat them. And what Gupta commented is that Sessions needs to step back and examine this a little more closely and see what the relationship is between discrimination, exclusion, ostracization, and these hate crimes that actually take place where there is violence inflicted. It's the permission implicit in the discrimination policies that embolden people who would harm the LGBTQ community.
Well, I agree with everything you both just said, but I'm still going to notch this off as a bright spot in the Trump administration.
It's certainly, yes, we want justice for this person whose name I am tragically forgetting. Rest in power, friend.
His real name was Kettery Johnson, went by the name of Candice at some points. A 16-year-old student in Burlington, Iowa, shot to death in March of 2016.
Right.
A gender fluid individual.
A tragedy.
It is.
And, you know, I haven't really talked about this on the show, although I think some of you know this in private. I have two children. My son, Max, is 19 years old, and he's a sophomore in college. My youngest child was born a girl and now identifies as a boy, and we now call him Elliot. And it's been a very interesting transition for us as a family. You know, you read about these things. You don't expect it in your family. I think we've handled it pretty well. But the thing that I wanted to bring up is, now I happen to live in Los Angeles County, California, which, as we all know, is one of the more liberal places on the planet.
Slightly, yes.
And I have to say, you know, when this first was brought up by Elliot in June, you know, we dealt with it as a family and we were all wrapping our heads around the name change and the things that go with it. And we didn't go public with it right away. You know, it's one of those things that you try on for size. Then we had to tell individual family members. But as Elliot started his junior year of high school in a new school and decided that he was going to be Elliot this year and identify, you know, as a boy and use the male restroom and everything else. And we started telling people, you know, how are your kids? How's Max? How's Marnie? And yet, you know, you have to say, well, Marnie is now Elliot, and you explain it to people. And what strikes me is I have yet to meet a person who had any type of a hesitancy, let alone a negative response. The response has been universally, whatever makes someone happy, God bless them.
And that's the beauty of visibility and demystification. It just the fear factor vanishes the more you see people who are embracing different gender identities. And it's lovely. It makes it easier.
It really
but
is.
But I am loath to throw shadow upon all of this, but unfortunately it is not universal.
That's true.
Look what happens in Iowa.
Yeah, and my wife and I know people who, in one of their previous workplaces, there was an investment advisor or something. I don't remember the particular details, but she was a transgender woman, and behind her, well, it was I hope it was at least behind her back. Some of the people around her referred to her as him, as a way to crack a joke. It was an
awful. Oh goodness,
that's so obnoxious.
Yeah.
It's small-minded at the very least.
Well, it's cruel because dead naming and misgendering somebody, it's just a cruelty. It's like, I hate being called Becky. If you were to start calling me Becky, it would just be a snotty, mean, cruel thing to do because I don't like it. And it's as simple as that.
It's juvenile.
By the way, I love the name Elliot, and I think your son shows well.
Yeah, thanks.
I agree.
And still the incredible, funny, bright person that he always was. Yeah.
And the thing is, the closest thing I've heard to an argument against this is the idea that if a person is born a boy or a girl, then that is, for lack of a better term, what God or what nature intended. Personally, I think Mother Nature is cruel, so that doesn't work for me at all. But, God also, for those of us who have male genitalia, we were born with foreskins, and I don't have one anymore. And there is still a very large faith that says when God gave us foreskins, we're supposed to get rid of them. So that's just something that is just simple and elemental and has been part of, you're supposed to change what God gave you for thousands of years, and to which we have now added childhood diseases, cancer when it comes to, there are all sorts of things that God has given us, but God has also given us the brains to come up with technology to reverse them if they harm us.
Well, the other argument that people say is God doesn't make mistakes. I'm like, no, God doesn't make mistakes. If there is a God, God makes some people trans, and we should accept that about them.
That's right.
It's not their anatomy that's a mistake. It's not even their mentality that's a mistake. It is our perceptions that are the mistake, and we need to get over that.
God gives people. I believe God gives people challenges, and some challenges are more challenging than others. Forgive the term, but if God, there's a line. If God wanted us to fly, He'd have given us wings. Yeah, well, God let us make airplanes, so clearly He doesn't want us on the ground all the time.
Well, one of the other things that God has made is Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, and now God apparently wants them to play together. What do you think?
First of all, that's an excellent segue.
Well done, Kevin.
Let's just start with that.
And on the eighth day, God made after-school activities.
So I'm a Girl Scout leader. I've mentioned this
I'm going to be one tomorrow. I start my Girl Scout Odyssey tomorrow. A sister to every Girl Scout.
Let's say both.
Nice. And actually, I'm told I'm like one of the only men in Southwest Ohio. And people identify me around here as, hey, there's that Girl Scout guy. I've walked out of like in schools like that I substitute at, and they'll go, hey, is that Girl Scout guy? Yeah, that's me. In like
there are way
like
worse
half
ways
an hour
to be
away.
Identified.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say this. I understand it. I get it. As a Girl Scout leader, I've been asked to go to Boy Scout like dinners and things like that for whatever. And Boy Scout camps are much cooler. They do more outdoor stuff. They're better funded. They do more activities. It's neater. Their badge levels are so much nicer. And it's not that we can't do those things. It's just, that's not our, well, say path, or it's not in our curriculum. So I get it. But at the same time, my wife was is a product of single sex education. And I get that too, about there's a time to have boys and girls and they need that space, you know, alone sometimes. And it's wonderful. So I see both sides and I'm really conflicted about this. So I have right now, it's each group is deciding how they want to approach it. So each I think each, the Boy Scouts call it dens.
No, it's a pack, and there are dens within packs.
Pack.
Dens are I'm a Boy Scout or Cub Scout parent. Pack is the bigger group, and deciding. Then dens are age specific, grade specific.
So each pack
would be deciding for themselves.
Right, and I think that's really the best way to decide. And I feel okay about that rather than a blanket statement. So I'm all right with it. Will my girls join now? My girls are going to stay Girl Scouts. And, you know, if I'm lucky, I'm going to try to push for some more activities. But, you know, it's what they get. What do you think, Rebecca, now that you've seen both sides?
Yeah, I'm on both sides of it. I think this is... I'm in danger of being misinterpreted here, but I don't mean to be pointing a finger at a particular religious group. I'm stating what I know to be a fact, or what I understand to be a fact. The Mormon Church is a very big supporter of scouting, and there are a lot of Mormon affiliated scout troops. And it's some significant number, like 20% of scout troops are chartered by Mormon wards. And I am wondering if there isn't an equivalent relationship between Mormons and Girl Scouts for whatever reasons. And if Mormon families would like to loop their daughters and their sisters into the program, and that's one of the reasons that Boy Scouts of America has decided to do this, because there is such a chunk of their membership that might really be looking for something for girls that the girls don't have an equivalent opportunity because Girl Scouting isn't as appealing to that particular group. So that's my theory on why they do that. They can increase their membership, and there's potentially a demand within a specific population. That being said, I think co-ed troops, where particularly at the later elementary and middle school ages, if they're conducted in a really egalitarian way, and the leadership makes sure that boys and girls are participating on absolutely level footing, it'd be really good for boys to see girls in that environment, to see girls take leadership in that environment, to in some ways compete with girls, to defer to girls, and to work with girls in that kind of collaborative way. I don't think it would be as good for girls. I think girls need single-sex spaces, particularly at the later elementary school and middle school years, to flex their own leadership, to learn about themselves, to learn how to work collaboratively with other women. I think girls need that space. And my one regret in my education is that I didn't have a single-sex education from maybe the ages of 12 to 15. I think that would have been a time that I would have done really well to absent myself from boys for parts of my education and my experiences. So I don't have a problem with girls joining Boy Scouts. And I think for some girls and for some packs, that's going to be awesome. My daughter's joining Girl Scouts.
And I just want to button this up by saying that if indeed 5 years of single-sex education would have made Rebecca any smarter, any more assertive, or any more powerful or successful in this world, I am jealous of the people that live in that alternative universe. I think that is a Rebecca that I would love to meet.
I'm just saying that I actually probably would have gotten a better education because I was too busy thinking about the boys I had a crush on to do my homework. And I basically stopped doing homework in middle school.
Seems to me whatever education you got worked out just fine.
Thank you, Gavin.
I want to thank our listeners for sticking with us on this long podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at MPU Podcast, and on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover all the fun that we have here on Mondays. We also want to remind you that if you like political debate and would like to debate with us between shows, we're all in a political Facebook group called Open Fire. We're all there, and we'd love to see you there, too. So, what are the troops, the Girl Scout troops, have on tap for tomorrow?
We are, it's our very first meeting of the Daisy Troop, so we're going to just try and, you know, keep them in the room and not climbing the walls.
We have a meeting tomorrow, too, actually, oddly enough, and I think they're going to decide whether I get to keep being a Girl Scout leader after yelling, John Kasich's an asshole.
See, Kevin, you're going to have to do some creative bleeping to save Greg's Girl Scout job.